The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Now, Parshas Truma comes after Mishpatim, just to get a sense of where we are. Parshas Yitro, God reveals himself to the Jewish people, face-to-face encounter. Parshas Mishpatim, the portion of Mishpatim, is a collection of principal laws that Jewish people accept. And we ended off Mishpatim with Moses going up to the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. And there are various opinions of that last segment, whether that comes after Mishpatim, and Moses has told them that, or rather that last segment comes before the whole story, even before Yitro, and that's just giving you a preview of what's to come, and then actually go into it, Moses goes up the mountain. Okay, now we get to Truma, and I just want to briefly size up the whole Parsha, and go into it and understand its thematic relevance to us. So Parshas Truma, the word Truma means a contribution, right? And and Moses is told to appoint fundraisers. Nice to know that there are the fundraisers in the world. To appoint fundraisers to receive contributions which are completely voluntary, 15 items specifically. In other words, you couldn't just give whatever you felt like, but you could give whatever you felt like from the list, the above list you could choose. Then Moses is instructed as to the building of the Aron. Inside the Mishkan, the tabernacle, it's like a sanctuary of some sort. It's like a traveling synagogue, but nothing like a synagogue. I'll show you some pictures in a second. Inside the tabernacle, well, let me show you some pictures now. The Midrash says, has a couple pictures, so they're very helpful. First of all, the tabernacle is the aerial view. It's a tent with these walls with standing beams. And inside the tent, there are three areas. The Holy of Holies, then there's the Holy, and then there's the Yard. Okay? And inside the Holy of Holies, you have, right in here is the Holy of Holies, you have an ark, which is today, symbolized in the ark in a synagogue. And in the ark were the Ten Commandments, the original tablets, and even later on, according to some opinions, I think all agree, even the broken pieces of the first Luchot, the first tablets, are inside. Okay, and therefore today we have the Torah inside the ark. They call it an Aron. This is an Aron, and the Aron is made out of it's a golden box inside a wooden box, which is then put into another golden box. So you have gold, wood, gold. Okay? And then on top of it is something called the kaporet, which is made out of complete gold. And it's one big chunk of gold, which hewn out of this chunk of gold is something called kruvim, which are, I can never get it straight, I think it's cherubims. And this one piece of gold, can you imagine this? This is one piece of gold. It's a top that goes, fits over top of the box, the Aron, where the Luchot are inside. And on top of it is a complete piece of gold. So the top and these angels, angel-like figures, are completely one piece. It's not like first they're constructed and then you stick it on. Right? No, they're actually one piece and the whole thing is carved out. And they have the faces of little children. One had the face of a boy, and the other had the face of a girl. Okay? And their wings are going up this way. And there's a crown-like ornament on around the side over here. Okay? So that is the Aron, and those are the Kruvim. Okay? Now, of course, there's many difficulties with this whole thing, because what does this look like? It looks like idol worship to me. I mean, it seems like just after all the various laws of do not affix to me any statues, do not affix to me any figures, and all those type of things, it is truly odd that at the very center of the Jewish experience are these two statue figurines, right? And that's just after we got the Ten Commandments telling us not to do that, and now we're told to do that. So that itself is something we have to clarify. Now the Midrash clearly is concerned with trying to understand some kind of symbolic character to the various items that go into the creating of all this. And there's a recurring theme in the Midrash of demonstrating how everything had some kind of connection to future sins that the Jewish people could probably do, and future merits in which the Jewish people might merit. So that's itself interesting. I mean, the fact that the items might suggest a certain merit that the Jewish people have, that's understandable. But the predominant theme, right, like I would say a vast majority of all the various items that go into and the materials that go into it suggest sins. For instance, the oral tradition says that the golden kruvim, the gold itself, is a reminder of the golden cow. Now, of course, as we'll talk about in a second, there is difference of opinion of whether this was commanded after the sin of the golden cow or whether this was commanded before the sin of the golden cow. It is certainly recorded in the Bible before the golden cow sin. Okay, but the question is, there are certain opinions that it's actually happening before, and the oral tradition seems to accept that opinion, even though the Ramban, Nachmani, does not. Okay, so that's the Kruvim. Then we are instructed, or then Moses instructed, to build a shulchan, a table. Now, it's not your regular kind of table. It looks like this. Okay, this is the table. Now, of course, everything you will see, not everything, but you have over here two poles. Because, of course, this was their portable tabernacle. This was a portable Beit HaMikdash. The temple, this is the original temple, but it was a portable. Right? It was very light, very easy to pack and to move very quickly. So they would hold it like this. It's made of wood, but again, it's overlaid with gold. Okay, the same thing. It's not really something you'd want to have your meal on, but it is a table. And what it has on this table are 12 breads, which are called show bread. And the reason why they're called show bread, or really they're called lechem panim, the bread of faces, is because it kind of looks like facing each other. This is a bread. Could you imagine you go into the supermarket and all of a sudden there's something weird? I mean, this is what it looked like. It was put in a certain mold, and this is what it would look like. That is the bread. It would mold exactly like that. And to a certain extent, it kind of looks like the Aron itself, with the two angels facing each other. That same kind of construction. So you have six on one side and six on the other side. Friday afternoon they were baked, and they were placed on Shabbos inside. They were changed. In other words, the bread from last week were now exchanged with the bread of this week. And the miracle was that the bread from last week was completely fresh. Not only was it fresh, but it was still warm. It was still warm. And this was a miracle. So you have this table, and it too has this kind of crown-like ornament, right? Because the table is suggestive of the crown of royalty. It's like a royal table. And the Aron has the Torah inside is the crown of Torah. Okay, they have the crown. There's the other crown, which is the crown of Kahuna, the crown of priestlyhood, which was on the Mizbeach, the altar. Yes, there's a bread that is slid into shelf-like things. Now, what we really should do is one day we'll go over to Esther's place, because this is, you'll be able to then see all the models of this. Okay, and then after the Shulchan, we are instructed in the construction of the menorah, the Kohanim Adam. Okay, and this is the menorah. Now again, this piece is one piece of gold. It's not like molding little pieces of gold and somehow fusing them together. This is actually one piece of gold that is molded into this. Okay, molded into this. Okay, so you have the menorah. Then we're told about the various curtains and the tapestry. That itself was quite unbelievable in terms of the way it looked. Then we are told about the building of the Mizbeach itself. the altar itself, which was, you get a basic sense, it had this incline on the top of it where brought the animal sacrifices. And it is set up like this. Over here you have the golden mizbech, which upon it was offered incense offerings, and that's inside here. These little squiggly lines are curtains, so you have the curtains, this is the kaddish, and inside here another curtain, this is the kodesh kodeshim, and over here is the yard. Okay, and this is how it's all set up. Now, there is an incredible amount of symbolism and Kabbalah and metaphysics go into it, but for the purpose of what we're trying to accomplish in this course, is to come up with a thematic understanding of how the Chumash works together, so we can come away with having a complete understanding of the mechanics and dynamics of the Chumash, and then allowing us perhaps in the future to again go into more of the details. So let's go back to the beginning and let's deal with some of the details and put it together and understand what is this Mishkan? Why is it here? What does it mean for the Jewish people? What does the temple mean for the Jewish people, which itself is the permanent expression of that portable? So first of all, according to Rashi, much Midrash, this has been instructed after the golden cow incident, right? Jewish people were waiting for Moses. He didn't come back exactly how they thought he would be back, and they got a little nervous, and they put together this golden cow itself, something that we'll have to talk about when we read it. And that this was actually instructed to them afterwards. Now, of course, based on that, we would then assume that the Mishkan is therefore a reaction to the creating of the golden cow. Right? And then there would be those who would try to express that really the Mishkan is bidi'evid. Bidi'evid meaning not in the ultimate initial intention of God, but God conceding to the downfall of Jewish people, recognizing their need. Right? The Sforno seems to allude to that approach. Just as we learned before, when God instructed Moses about building a Mizbeach, and he said you can build a Mizbeach out of dirt, right? So the Sforno says, had the Jewish people not sinned, a simple altar of dirt would have sufficed. Right? But after the sin, they then were instructed to build a very elaborate Mishkan as this. That is seemingly what the Sforno was implying. Could be we're wrong in understanding it. But that seems to be what he says. Most opinions would argue with that completely. Right? Completely argue with that. That being that the Torah records this before the sin, even though chronologically, historically, maybe it happened after the sin, but if the Torah records it before the sin, that means it's teaching us that it has meaning before the sin. Right? It has meaning before the sin. And even though the Midrash says that God brings the antidote before the sickness, right? Referring to this, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that the Mishkan is not intentionally the ultimate, right? But rather that's what the ultimate means, which we'll clarify in a second. But we have to put this down and understand it. Okay? So most opinions would not accept that this is just bidi'evid. Most opinions, I mean, all except I've seen the Sforno, and then there would be maybe scholars. But the other opinions do not accept that. The other opinions are that since it was written before the sin, right? Then that means that it had meaning way before the sin. It was the intention of God before the sin. And the fact that maybe chronologically God instructed Moses about it after the sin really is not because of the sin. Even though it has allusions that relate to the sin, it itself has meaning independent of the sin. So that would be one approach. Of course, we'll have to figure out what is that meaning. The other approach is that, in fact, this is happening way before the sin. And it's going according to how it's recorded chronologically. And this is the Ramban's approach, Nachmanides. Ramban says that how is this whole thing working? The Jewish people just heard the Ten Commandments at Sinai. They had the face-to-face experience with God. Okay? By the way, the Ramban's opinion is that the Jewish people personally heard all Ten Commandments. There are other opinions. I believe Rashi holds it only the first two. Okay? The Ramban holds that they heard all ten. Personally. And after the Ten Commandments, after that face-to-face, then Moses was commanded mishpatim, various particular laws which relate to the Ten Commandments and are considered to be like principal laws, which is like in you have the same kind of idea in the laws of Shabbat. You have like an av melacha, which is like a father law, and then there's the particular ramifications of that law. So too you have over here, the mishpatim represent a certain principal bulk of halakha. And just as when you're about to convert somebody, or if a person wants to be converted, of course you can't teach them the entire Torah, because to learn Torah is a lifetime business. But there are certain principal laws. So too, the Ramban says they had the face-to-face experience encounter with God. They heard the Ten Commandments. They were then told principal laws, which are brought down in Mishpatim, and that is the bare minimum for them to be considered like a convert, meaning they have now entered into a covenant with God, and they have become holy. And you shall be unto me a holy nation. Okay, so this is really happening after all this, as the culmination and as the expression of all this. According to the Ramban, after Moses effectualized with the Jewish people the covenant based on the face-to-face, the Ten Commandments, and the various mishpatim laws that are expressed in the parsha prior to this, then God commands him as to the building of the Mishkan. Why? Because you are befitting now to have my holiness, right? You're befitting now that you shall have a mikdash, right? For the indwelling of my spirit amongst you. Okay? So now, what does that mean? Now that the Jewish people have entered into that kind of relationship with God, now that the Jewish people have defined themselves based on their relationship with God, they now are commanded in the construction of a Mishkan, a tabernacle, which is a reflection of that kind of closeness. Right? That now God is close to the Jewish people, intimate with the Jewish people, consistently with them and guiding them and amongst them. Okay, so the Mishkan is itself a manifestation, an externalization, an objectification of the face-to-face encounter of the Jewish people and it being solidified through the giving of the Torah and the Brit. Okay? Now, according to the Ramban, what it really is a portable Mount Sinai. Yes, you too, for only, can get yourself a portable Mount Sinai. And he goes to show, he continues to illustrate how what's going on with the tabernacle correlates to what happens at the mountain. Right? And therefore, that moment on the mountain, that face-to-face, and everything that mountain expresses to the Jewish people is now translated into a model. Right? And that model will accompany the Jewish people forever, because it is a consistent testimony that the Jewish people now exist in a face-to-face encounter with God. That what happened at Sinai wasn't one moment, right? But what happened at Sinai in time is now translated into the tabernacle beyond time, right? And now accompanies the Jewish people forever. Okay? Something that people have to understand. That what happened at Sinai wasn't just a one-time thing. But what happened at Sinai was a transformation of a people. In terms of who they are, and that transformation and that ongoing face-to-face with God is now expressed, objectified, which is more than symbolizing. It's not a symbol. It's actually a physical objectification, externalization of a spiritual reality which the Jewish people have now attained. Right? Something that you must understand. That all the mitzvot, they're not spiritual symbols, right, that hint to something. They are actually a physical objectification, taking that reality and putting it, so to speak, in an object that reflects that inner experience that has been established in the world. Okay? So it's more than just simply a symbol. It is an expression of what really is right now. Right? A solidification of it, you might call it. A concretizing of it. Okay, so just as God settled on the mountain, the honor of God was seen on this mountain, so too, from now on, the honor of God would fill and rest upon the Mishkan, upon this tabernacle. And the word Mishkan comes from the word Shachein, which means to dwell upon. It's the dwelling place of God. Now, of course, do we then believe that God lives in a house? Yeah, why not? Now, we don't believe that. But rather, the Mishkan is, again, the objectification of a spiritual elevation that the Jewish people have achieved, that now I will dwell in you. Right? I will dwell in you, and that is exactly what it says in the verse. In chapter 25, verse 8, you shall make for me a mikdash, v'shalchanti b'tocham, and I will dwell in them. Who will I dwell in? Not in it, b'tocho, it should have said, in it, but in them. Right? The dwelling of the Spirit of Hashem with the Jewish people, that the Jew becomes a sanctuary for the divine, accommodating the divine in this world. That is objectified in the building of the Mishkan. Outside is itself an expression of that building inside. That you now become a living sanctuary for the divine that rests within the individual. So, the tabernacle is the embodiment, so to speak, of the face-to-face encounter of the Jewish people with God and its implications. And therefore, that itself is suggested in the two kruvim facing each other, face-to-face. And on Yom Tov, on festival days, when the Jewish people would come up to the tabernacle, to the Beit HaMikdash, the Gemara Yuma records that they would open up the curtains and all could see into the Holy of Holies. And what would they see on a Yom Tov? They would see these two angels embracing each other. Could you imagine that? But if the Jewish people were not up to par to who they are and who they should be, then they would see these two angels turning their faces from each other. That's what it says. They would see, and that itself would be an indication that something's not kosher amongst us and that something's breaking down in our face-to-face with God. Our responsibility, our ability to respond directly. God calls and I answer. That's face-to-face. I am not fulfilling my responsibility. The face-to-face breaks down. Okay? So the tabernacle and everything in it is the embodiment of that encounter. Right? And a reflection of whether that encounter is truly present amongst us right now or not. Okay? And in Mishkan even goes beyond that. The Sfarno points out, and the Ramban also accepts this, that the Mishkan actually is a physical manifestation of the spiritual system, the heavenly celestial system that is seen in the vision of prophets. The prophets would see angels in the holy throne, and upon the holy throne would be angels, ministering angels, and upon that they would see the vision of God. And so their vision, the vision of the prophet, is actually translated into a physical form, which is the Mishkan, right? Which is again the Mishkan and the Kruvim, okay? Now it says over here in the Torah itself, God says to Moses, and you shall come into the Ohel Moed, which is the Mishkan, and the Mishkan is called an Ohel Moed, which means literally a meeting place. Because just as Moses would go up to the mountain and hear the voice of God from fire, coming from amidst fire, now the traveling Mount Sinai, the portable Mount Sinai will accompany them, and in the ongoing relation between God and the people, Moses being their spokesman and the delegate, Moses would be called into the Ohel Moed, right, and he would place his head between the two angels. And it was right between the two angels that the voice of God would be heard. Right? So we literally have here an ongoing Mount Sinai with us. It's not a history. And that mountain isn't holy for us anymore. Nobody goes up to that mountain and makes shrines and things like that. We don't even know where it is. Because it's not the place that's holy, it's the relationship that took place there. And once that relationship is now transferred into the Beit HaMikdash, it's that Beit HaMikdash which will be holy. You follow? Therefore, the ongoing direct relationship with God is happening through the Mishkan. Moses would put his head in between these two angels, and it would be there that he would hear the voice of God. We have to appreciate that what happened at Sinai was an entire nation completely accepted their identity to be defined by their relationship with God. Like most people's identity, most nations' identity is defined by their weapons, their economy, right, their treasury, their land, their army. But the Jewish people is really the only nation that defines its existence, its strength, its meaning in terms of its relationship with God. And we talked about this before, which happens with Avram, but now the Abrahamic experience is now translated onto a national level, which is the beginning of Tikkun Olam, the fixing of the world, which will then be superimposed upon the international universal reality. The nation has accepted their identity, and you know, this idea of the I-thou, that an I is defined by a you. Right? There's no such thing as an I without a you, and therefore part of my I is you. Right? That itself is cute, in a very cute way, reflected in very many of Escher's wood carvings, which we have one up here, which is every individual is actually defined by all the other individuals. That means that one man, pick whatever man you want, within him is included all the others. His identity is actually to the inclusion of the totality. He's an individual, and yet his definition includes the whole. Okay? And so too, each individual is defined by the other. That means that we include each other. So in my I is your you, and in your you is my I. Now if I enter into an I-you relationship with God, that means that my I, its definition includes the divine you. This is called the Shekhinah. This is the divineness within mankind. Right? I don't become divine, I don't become you, and yet there's so much of you that's within me. And should we break up, you've taken away the greatest part of me. You know, we have to use very important sources. Anyways, so that's the idea over here. That God is so close to you, you are so one with God, there is that kind of mutual inclusiveness now, that God includes me within his reality and I include God. The mystical illusion of that in Kabbalah is the Tzimtzum. That in the beginning there was just a divine light. God made a space within his light to create vessels. And the ultimate vision is the vessel will be within the light and the light will be in the vessel. But when God offered his light to the vessels, they broke. Well, we are coming to the moment of the fixing of the vessels at this relative point. Because the Mishkan is the fixing of the vessel that can now hold the light of God. The Jewish people are now able to incorporate the divine within their own human definition. The imminent divine is now exposed within them and amongst them. And so you have to appreciate that the building of the tabernacle is itself the objectification of the resting of the Shekhinah within the human being. The vessel now able to hold the light and enter into that kind of mutual inclusiveness of oneness, of non-duality with Hashem. Right? So this is like, wow. And of course it makes sense because they have now heard the Ten Commandments, personally heard God. They have been revealed to them the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei Elohim. They have now had various laws that translate that into the daily. They've accepted the Brit, and now they have the temple, which itself is the objectification of that truth, that they have come to that kind of oneness with God, and that kind of unity with Hashem, where the Spirit of God is now within the world. Now, that itself can only be through the unity of the people. We learned that the Jewish people as a unity stood in front of the mountain in singular verb, because only through unity that they could enter into that relationship with God and receive the Torah. And therefore the Mishkan itself is a model of the unity of the people. It is not only a model, a objectification of the face-to-face relationship between God and the people, it's not only an objectification of the visions that one has in prophecy and face-to-face, but it is also the objectification of the unity of the people. The unity of the people with God and the unity of the people between themselves. And therefore, you couldn't just say, I'll send to the UJA $100 and do what you want. It had to be my gold, my silver. There was a list of items that I would take from my house and give. Right? And so you would know that your golden cup that you offered to be melted down right? You would know that that is in the tabernacle, right? An unbelievable thing, right? To be able to go there, and there were no plaques, you know, Joe Bernstein or Benny Schwartz, right? No, it was itself the unity of the entire nation. So the unity of the nation, the unity of the nation with God, and the tabernacle itself, in terms of the way it's constructed, had no iron in it. All the items and all the materials exclude iron. Why? The Svarno says because iron is what you make weapons out of. Right? And therefore, not only was it not made out of iron, but iron tools were not even used in its construction. Because it is the ultimate of peace. Peace between the people, peace between the people and God. Okay? And itself, it reflects, according to the Midrash, there are various allusions. It reflects an individual. The ark is like the heart. And the kruvim are like the lungs. And the table is like the stomach. And the menorah is like the human mind that's illuminated. The altar for the incense is the sense of smell. And the urn for the water wash your hands is the liquid of the body. And then it was made of skins around it, which is the skin of the human being. And the beams look like ribs. Right? In other words, there's all these allusions, right, are to the individual. But then the Midrash also goes on to bring in allusions to Klal Yisrael. The Ark is like the Talmid Chacham. And the Shulchan is the king. And the altar is the Kohanim. And the menorah is like the Torah leaders. And there's various allusions to Klal Yisrael, the nation. And there is allusions to the universe. The curtains representing the upper heavens and the lower heavens. Heaven and earth. The water representing the water, and there's various allusions to the universe. So what you have expressed in the Mishkan is the individual, the nation, and the universe. Right? Because the Mishkan itself is that unity with God where the particular now has reflected in it the universal reality. Right? The ultimate vision of reality. Where the unity of God is revealed through that kind of non-duality where the particular, the individual, is so one with God that the universal reality of Hashem is now reflected within them. Okay? So, we have to appreciate that really the Mishkan is the fulfillment of creation. And that when it was finished, the Gemara says that there was no joy in the world like this since the creation of the world itself. Right? And the Midrash says that until the Mishkan was built, the world was very unstable, and it was shaking. Its foundations were about to collapse until the Mishkan was built. Why? Because the Mishkan reflects the fulfillment of the purpose of creation. Because the purpose of creation of God is God wants to give of His goodness to another. That an individual could enter into that kind of love relationship with God, that kind of unity, that they themselves would incorporate godliness within them through that unity without becoming God. Giving of His goodness, and the greatest goodness of God is Himself, to an other. To love mankind and to enable mankind to love God and enter into that mutual inclusiveness. And that is what the Mishkan is all about. The Mishkan is the vessels that have now been built. Now, all the vessels aren't built because the whole world has not yet been able to accommodate the divine. But this is a step forward in the visions of Judaism. That now the vessels are built. And the honor of God fills the vessel. And the honor of God fills the individuals. And the universal reality is now incorporated within the particular. So really the building of the Mishkan, which follows after the Ten Commandments, which follows after the Mishpatim, which follows after covenant with God, the face-to-face, that face-to-face love is embodied in the Mishkan. It is those two kruvim embracing each other, that kind of relationship between Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, and God. The interesting thing about this all is why is it made of various items which suggest sin. Right? We would think that that's not appropriate. I mean, if it represents love, unity, that mutual inclusiveness of identities, where my beloved is part of me, and I am part of my beloved, that my beloved almost shares a single identity with me, and yet that we are not the same, right? So why in the world would I build our house of love, so to speak, out of items which suggest future sins, right? Well, you see, that's the highest level of love. It's unconditional love. Where my love is not built on what makes me perfect, blind to my imperfections, but my love includes even the imperfections. That even though the Jewish people, when they were standing at Sinai, they were like angels. Right? Do you think the face-to-face relation with God is based on you being an angel? The face-to-face relation with God is based on you being a human being. Taking into consideration your human shortcomings. And therefore, it alludes to atonement. The entire building alludes to atonement. Right? In fact, the top where these angels are propped on is called the kaparet, which means literally an atonement. And the curtain is called a parochet, which is the same letters as kapara. And it's made out of gold, just like the golden cow. And all the various items, if you look in the Midrash, and the Midrash says brings it down, right? Various allusions to various sins that the Jewish people would do, and you say, that's ridiculous. But that's love. That's really love, unconditional love, where, now that we've effectualized that kind of unity, right? It goes beyond din. That house is the house of compassion. It goes beyond judgment. It includes a recognition of your shortcomings. And yet, still, your very shortcomings can contribute, are not only included in the building of that love palace, but will even contribute to it. Right? You see, you have to understand, before you get married, if you have a fight between yourself and your beloved, that could only bring it down. Right? That would be the end of your relationship. Before there's a commitment, a fight is only going to undermine the possibility of coming to a place of commitment. Before commitment, fights minimize the possibility of commitment. But after commitment, fights are included in the commitment. And not only included, but even the fights themselves could contribute to an even greater experience and appreciation of our commitment after the commitment. When a husband and a wife, after commitment, before commitment, right, you're living together, no commitment, you fight, that's the end of the relationship. After the commitment, what happens? After the commitment, you feel so hurt, you feel so separate. But then you say, how can I do this? What, am I crazy? Fighting with you is like fighting with myself. Separating from you is like cutting out my own heart. Why, I understand why we are crazy, and it's very possible that after that very fight, that fight and that forgiveness contributes and solidifies even more so our commitment. It becomes, sometimes the fight becomes the very material that create an incredible marriage. Right? Something that people don't realize. So therefore, it's unbelievable how the tabernacle itself is made of materials which allude to future sins that the Jewish people would do, therefore expressing to us that the love after the commitment at Sinai that they have achieved is objectified in a building which includes your downfall, which includes human faults, which includes the possibility to make mistakes, which includes the possibility to say I'm sorry and to be forgiven, and yet nothing will bring it down, because the house itself is a house of atonement. And everybody knows the cute hint that even in the English word atonement means at one mint. That's really what it is. at one. When I sin, I am separating myself from God. When I sin, I'm turning my back on God. And yet, when I do a mitzvah, I am once again ready to face God and enter into that kind of relationship. So the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan, they all express, they are an objectification of that ongoing relationship with God, that testimony that the Shekhinah is with us, and that we've come to such a union with God, that God has now become included in our world, included in our time, included in our space, included in our being. Right? And that is what the Beis HaMikdash is all about. It is the fulfillment of creation, because that is what creation was for. It was for that kind of relation between man and God. It was the expression of divine love. Now, the Beit HaMikdash itself, later on, is the permanent expression of that tabernacle which was portable. And when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, when they went into the temple as it was being destroyed, they saw, and the enemy saw, that the two kruvim were embracing each other. Can you imagine that? And when the enemy walked in and saw in the Beit HaMikdash, at the very center, this holy place of the Jews, the very center, the Holy of Holies, and they opened up that curtain, what did they see? They saw these two figurines. Right? These two figurines embracing each other. They laughed. And they said, this is what it's all about. This is what's at the center of the Jewish people. They laughed. They scoffed at it. And yet, yes, this is exactly what's at the center of the Jewish people. The love between man and God. That's all. That's it. That's the essence of life. There's nothing more that anybody could want than that kind of sense of oneness with Hashem. That kind of sense of oneness with their fellow man. So they scoffed at it. But the question is, why are these two angels embracing each other? If the temple is being destroyed, we know it was destroyed because of devastating sins of the Jewish people. So some of the commentaries say it was to demonstrate that even the destruction was an act of God's love. Rather I destroy my house than my people. Rather I, so to speak, spend my wrath upon the people than on wood and stone than upon the people. So the temple is that kind of oneness with God. And the most amazing thing about it is that its very essence, at its very core, are two figurines which generally would mean the ultimate of sin, idol worship. God is teaching us even the ultimate of sin, even the antithesis of Judaism. Even if you transgress the antithesis of Judaism, right, it is from there still that you can once again receive an atonement with God. And that in general, that would have been a transgression. But in this case, it's not, because it was the expressed will of God that so it should be done. In itself, a testimony that even if you sin, even if you go to the furthest place, the antithesis of Judaism, idol worship, even that ultimately, because God's love with us is unconditional, could be transformed and become a source of my union with God once again. Even the most devastating fight with my beloved, if it is a fight after commitment, a fight within the context of unconditional love, even that fight could be transformed into a new source of greater commitment between us. Okay? And this is the Mishkan. Now, the second temple, being that the Jewish people were not on the level of the first temple, it did not have the Aron, it did not have the Ark, it did not have... In the first temple, there was a heavenly fire that would descend and consume the sacrifices. It didn't have that. It didn't have the Ruach HaKodesh, which we'll talk about in the next portion, which deals with the Urim V'Tumim, that they would ask questions of the breastplate on the high priest's chest. And, of course, it didn't have the Kruvim. It didn't have those angels. It was not on the level of the first temple. Right? Because the Jewish people had not succeeded in once again coming to that sense of responsibility, that face-to-face with God, that it should be objectified in such a manner yet. Okay, any questions on what we did today? So the Midrash says that that Shlomo Melech, when he built the first temple, he had prophesied and understood that it would be destroyed. And therefore he built a vault underneath it. Underneath the Holy of Holies is, according to the Midrash, a vault. And it would be there that it would be concealed. And therefore, we believe that much of the vessels, I mean, some are obviously taken away, as we see in pictures of Rome. And in the Vatican, I had a student whose father was at the Vatican, and someone came out to greet him, and his father was connected to a museum in his little town somewhere in Omaha or something. And he said, "Are you from the museum?" And he said, "Well, yes, I am, in fact." He said, "Oh, we've been waiting for you. Come in." And he took this man, showed him the Pope's bedroom, right, and then took him through a secret door from the Pope's bedroom into an area. And this fellow's uncle is not religious. Not religious would be a fantastic picture, right? And he takes him downstairs, and he shows him, right, what he said were the vessels of the Jewish temple. So he got from his uncle, who saw this personally, okay? Personally saw this. So therefore, there seems, I mean, according to this story, his uncle says that they showed him vessels of the temple. Now the truth is, what happened is he started asking more questions, and he found out, he thought he was from the British Museum. And he made a mistake. So then he quickly got him out of there. But so there are, seems to be that the Vatican actually does have our vessels. But there seems to be also some vessels that are in the vault itself. Well, that's what the Midrash says, that it was taken in there, and therefore we think it's there. Now, archaeologists have tried to get in there, to get into this vault, to dig. And of course, the Arabs will not let anybody up there and start digging holes on Temple Mount. So I was told that the archaeologists then tried to dig sideways. You got the mountain, dig sideways. And the Arabs stomped that too. So the Arabs, I guess, are just ministering messengers of God that if we're not ready for it, I mean, what are they going to do with this ark anyways? Until the vessels become something more than an heirloom, or something more than just something to be seen in a museum, but are actually a testimony of the great yearning that the Jew is imbued with, because the Jew knows that their identity is bound up with God, and they are one with Hashem in love. Until that point, that's the base of Migdash we have to build. We have to first build the base of Migdash that's in our hearts. There is two things that are really important to see, and perhaps we could try and arrange it in a group level. There is the museum that Esther is in charge of, which is the model of the temple. And then there is another group that have created something called the Temple Treasures, or Treasures of the Temple, and that's also in the Old City. And they have, which will be really important for the next Parsha, they have already begun to tailor the clothing of the Kohen HaGadol. They've already built, according to Jewish law, various vessels that will be used, or they hope will be used, in the temple.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.